front page coverage, and that a serial killer of four Indigenous women, it's not just about the serial killer, it's also about the victims.
Mm.
We see that in every story, that they're not just a one-off mention. People are writing about who they were as people, their families, that who their supporters are in the courtroom. Really, I'm noticing a trend towards humanizing these victims rather than in the past where they were somewhat blamed or vilified.
And just the massive amount of media coverage at the beginning of this case, when there was the debate over whether or not the dump should be searched, that made it a huge election issue. Election issues are not won or lost usually on Indigenous people or Indigenous people's needs, and certainly not on the needs of Indigenous women. So that was absolutely historic.
Yeah, and now we have the first First Nations Premier of Manitoba. You know, it's incredible how these elements run into each other. But when the former premier and of the Progressive Conservatives said, no, we're not going to search, then made it a pillar of her campaign. She was criticized top to bottom, and she stuck to it. They even said, you don't have to tell your friends and family you're voting for us, but we're standing firm. We're not searching the landfill. And she said, we're worried about employees who are going to have to go in there and deal with hazardous chemicals and whatnot. And I remember I called the union and said, are you the union representing workers in the landfill? Yes. Are your employees concerned? No. So then we were wondering, who is the premier referring to? Obviously playing towards the Tory base, I guess, but the Tories were thrown out, which is the first time ever in Manitoba history they weren't in power back-to-back, and the NDP came in under this new untested leader, who was Wob Kanu, the first First Nations premier in Manitoba. When he came in, one of the first things he said is, we're going to search the landfill.
And all of that, blow-by-blow, played out in the media.
The reason it became a political issue was because I think the families did such a masterful job of keeping it in the news.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for them having National Search the Landfill Day, having protests, encampments, marches that got support across Canada, it became this rallying cry, like, search the landfills, you know, bring the women home. And what if it was your mom or your daughter?
Mm-hmm.
And the families have had to drive this every step of the way and push politicians, keep their feet to the fire. And I think they deserve all the credit that it will hopefully happen once the trial is over.
Oh, they definitely do.
They've made it so we can't turn away, and we have to cover it because society wants to know. The public wants to know. And I think a lot of that has come out of, you know, the unmarked graves there by Kamloops and that reckoning that followed, and how, yeah, we need to know more, and we need to do more. And that we've had to step up as media. Not only AP10's been doing it for years, but now these issues we used to cover as a niche broadcaster, they're now mainstream news.
So what's next in the case, Kathleen?
Well, the forensic psychiatrists for both sides will tell the court about their assessment of his mental capacity and could he have formed the intent to commit what the Crown says are racially motivated, hate-filled crimes that followed a pattern. Once the case concludes, then we're into the back half, which is potential search of the landfill for the remains of Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, and Buffalo Woman. We have to remember that only Rebecca Contois' remains were recovered.
Kathleen, I want to thank you so much for coming on and getting us up to date on this case.
Thank you. It's important. So I really appreciate you making the time for it.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at karen@canadaland.com. That's Karen, K-A-R-Y-N, because I spell it differently. Or you can email jesse@canadaland.com. He really does read them all. Our website is canadaland.com. This episode featured reporting from Kathleen Martins from APTN. Thank you, Kathleen. Bruce Thorson is our senior producer. Tristan Capocchione is our audio editor and technical producer. I'm your host, Karen Pugliese, editor-in-chief of Candleland. Our theme music is by So Called, Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Writer, researcher, co-host of Pretendians, Robert Jago, joining me from Vancouver. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm all right. Today on the show, Robert, politician, publisher, Pretendian, meet the new owner of the Winnipeg Sun. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Kevin Kline, the former city councillor, former Winnipeg mayoral candidate, and former PC MLA, is about to become the new owner of the Winnipeg Sun. The Post media chain announced today it's selling the Sun to the Kline Group, led by the former politician.
It is important that we provide the news that's necessary, that we play that vital role, that we live up to our obligations, and that we uphold the principles of journalistic integrity.
The deal on the table would see the Kline Group acquire the Sun, the graphic leader in Portage La Prairie, and the Kenora Miner in News.
Huh. You know, I've been waiting for this to happen. You know, I was wondering, Robert, at what point do the, you know, the local newspapers that were scooped up into chains like Post Media, at what point does Post Media start selling them back to the communities, to like smaller local business people? Because, you know, the Post Media has said these papers are not sustainable. And maybe one of the only kind of like hopeful paths for local news is that these get cheap enough that they get sold back to community. Is that what's going on here? Like, who in the year 2024 buys a bunch of newspapers?
Yeah, I was looking at that business deal. It looks like Post Media is trying out a new SaaS approach to operating news.
Software as a service for our listeners.
That's right. Yeah. So with this deal, they operate all of their international news and their national news, and they become like a news service, and they feed into the new group, who then, I guess, just focuses on local news exclusively.
Tell me more about that. I missed this detail.
Okay. So the detail is that this becomes an independent paper, but it's still, as part of the sales package, licenses news and content from Post Media.
Yeah, that makes sense because, I mean, essentially what's been happening to these local papers is that the local news gathering rooms and editorial staff has been picked away and picked away and picked away to a point where these papers have just sort of had a local masthead, and then syndicated content either from the Post Media's, the news service itself, or from any of the wire services, and they just sort of been zombie newspapers. So if you're going to strip away these papers and try to make a go of them locally, then you would want to still have the benefit of that content from the Post Media network. That's interesting. I missed that detail about like they're still going to be connected to the Borg in that way. Okay, sign of hope. Like, you know, if we take this guy, Kevin Kline, not to be confused with Fish Called Wanda actor, local politician, former publisher of the Winnipeg Sun, if we take him at his word, he's trying to do right by local news. Do we take him at his word? Is there any reason you can think of as you're getting to know this guy, Robert, to doubt his good word or his claims? What's come to your attention, Robert?
Sure. So when he was a minister for the Progressive Conservatives and ran an election campaign on not recovering the bodies from the landfills.
Just some context for our listeners here. He was running for the Conservatives in Manitoba, who campaigned in part on the fact that they did not want to search the landfills for the remains of four Indigenous women who were victims of a serial killer.
He was also at the same time claiming to be Métis. And claiming to be Métis as a personal, private matter that he told everybody about.
Recently, Manitoba Cabinet Minister Kevin Kline became the subject of controversy after claims about his Métis ancestry came into question.
Kline has a Métis card from a for-profit Ontario company called Painted Feather Woodland Métis.
And as I said, I don't claim to be Métis for politics. I did it beforehand.
His government biography says Kevin Kline is a proud Métis Canadian.
Well, look, in our party, we don't police people's identity.
I want to speak from a place that no one else in council can speak from. My Indigenous mother was murdered.
CBC News could not find any evidence of Kline's maternal Métis ancestry. Kline is now refusing to answer questions about his heritage, saying it's a private and personal journey.
Publisher, politician, pretendian?
There's a lot that's wrong with that story. Number one, relying on a fake Métis nation is pretty bad. And number two, that story about his mother doesn't seem to check out once people start to look into it. So his mother was not Métis. And that's something that you see with some of the worst cases of pretendians, where they establish their bona fides by pulling on Native trauma and dressing themselves in it like a costume. And to do that, well, as a minister, you're refusing to actually investigate Native trauma. And also, and I'm sorry, but having anybody in government say we don't police Native identity is idiotic. Because, in fact, just as a matter of policy, they police Native identity quite aggressively.
You just mean that there are federally issued status cards?
Well, not just federally issued status cards, but policy as well. And a different set of rights. Like, if I die without a will, there's different laws surrounding it for me as a status Indian than there would be for you.
Right. And I don't know if they're policing it, but they are determining it. That is the business of government.
They are policing it, or actually under-policing it, I suppose. They offer different and inferior levels of service because you're an Indian. This is the whole reason there's things like Jordan's principle.
Yeah. Painted Feather Woodland Métis.
That sounds hella sacred. It's got all of it.
It's got all the things.
If there was an onomatopoeia for the sound that a flute makes as it's blown mystically over the woods, it would be included in that name.
Kevin Kline is a Jewish name. So I thought, oh, is this a Jewish guy pretending to be Métis?
Well, it is Manitoba.
And there's plenty of Jewish people in Manitoba. I don't think Kevin Kline is one of them, or at least I don't believe so, because Kline is not his birth name. His birth name was Harold Kevin Rout Jr. And sometime before his second marriage in 1994, he changed it to Kevin Elvis Kline. Interesting guy. I don't know what the impetus was for renaming himself Kevin Elvis Kline. I guess Ralph Kline was a popular politician out west.
Yeah, and right at that time, he was kind of a really big, influential, down-to-earth guy. So, and he used that spelling. You know, Kevin Kline spells it K-L-I-N-E, the real Kevin Kline.
We should add to this, in fairness, that to some extent, he took responsibility for this. He published a post to his website in which he called this an error in judgment that is my own, and I acknowledge it. I guess, Robert, he did what you would hope somebody would do when they have made false or flawed Indigenous ancestry claims. He removed it from his public profiles. So that's part of the story as well.
If he were a pretendian in academia or almost anywhere else, if he were like a pretending actor and said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that anymore, I think it's probably a good place to let it lay. Like, it's fine, it's done. You know, even without a big apology, if he just promises to stop doing it, I think that's the most you could ask for. However, if he's going to make it his day job to influence people, and if he said that while in government in an election campaign that was pretty anti-Native, I think it hits different. And without the apology, it doesn't really ring true. And it just sets off a lot of warning bells that this is a person who you need to watch out for. To be there in this very Native place and to be so disconnected from Native culture that you could even think that those flimsy claims of your made-up tribe are a real thing, it says that, you know, this is a person who probably isn't capable of properly reporting on Indian country, which is a shame because Winnipeg is the capital of it.
I'm intrigued in people who want to buy newspapers, like at any time. It's interesting because it's always like, is that a business decision or is that I want to mold the way people think decision?
Yeah. No, I mean, as a business, it's one step up from politics because politics is pissant. The amount of money involved is paltry compared to like a corner store or a supermarket. And modern Canadian newspapers are barely a step up from that.
I'm very curious as well about the economics of this for a couple of reasons. I mean, one thing is that, like, is he actually the new owner of these newspapers? According to a filing with Manitoba's company's office, he is not listed as owning 10% of the shares of the company that bought the Winnipeg Sun and these two other newspapers. Like, he is a minority shareholder in the Klein Group. So who is backing this and why? And the Globe and Mail goes ahead and reports that he is not ruling out running against Wab Kinew to be the next premier, conservative premier of Manitoba. So is this an old-fashioned acquisition of newspapers to buy public influence to fuel his political ambitions?
Well, I mean, that's what I was suggesting there. Like, it is a very cheap way to get outsized influence. I imagine that class of people.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that older class of people, they're the less people who still read newspapers.
So I think that what we might have here is like an old-fashioned reason for a business person to buy a bunch of newspapers.
Yeah, it's the first 45 minutes of Citizen Kane.
Yeah, it's the micro 2024 version of Citizen Kane, where you're not like a super wealthy scion. I make no comment or endorsement of his like actual agenda. I don't know. Before I put myself in the ridiculous and tortured position of defending these newspapers under Kevin Klein, before we know what he's even going to do with them, I'll bring an end to this segment by saying, I guess we'll wait and see.
Well, we'll wait and see until they disclose who actually owns it. That'll tell you everything. Although it may be like a personal private matter, like his Métis heritage.
Robert, we're going to duly note some things that people should know more about. And I am going to duly note your podcast, Pretendians, the show that you are hosting with Angel. This is shameless, but it's so good, Robert. The process of making the show with you was, for me, the dynamics are all there. Where as publisher, I'm like, I want this to be entertaining to everybody. And then you and Angel are saying, well, we don't want this to be like people gawking at us. And we don't want to be sensationalizing something that matters. And I'm like, I'm okay with that, but it's got to be entertaining. And then you're saying, well, we're okay with it being entertaining because we want people to listen to it. And then our editor-in-chief, Karen, is saying, okay, but it's got to be super accurate because we're talking about like real people in their lives here. And through those dynamics, it just sort of became something so wonderful. Episode by episode, it's just going into such interesting and nuanced territory. The most recent episode is Angel looking at the governor of Oklahoma. Robert, you remember like the fear at the beginning was, is every episode going to be the same? Like just another story of a faker. And it just has like not been an issue. Like this episode is so different than the last one. And the connection with Pretendianism is very surprising with this guy. And then the next episode about Pretendian hunters, I just think you're doing like a tremendous job. It's so interesting. And you and Angel are funny as hell. Anyhow, I am duly noting it because the show is in that place where our audience is turning on to it and people who pay attention to Indigenous issues are turning on to it and like people we respect in podcasting. It's doing well and it's just sort of like on the cusp of like breaking out and becoming some bigger thing. And I want people to be talking about this stuff. That was the goal from the start. So I'm not going to stop plugging it. It's such good work. I want to congratulate you on it. It's awesome.
Thank you. I'm really excited for the second episode, the prison one. I'm obsessed with that one. I'm writing an article for that. It's going to come out soon. And I'm really excited for the next episode. I like the governor episode. I want to see that get more attention. The problem is that a million tornadoes just hit Oklahoma at the same time the episode came out. So it's not really, it's kind of buried below that in the local news cycle. But I'm really excited for the next one. That's where we look at the Pretendian hunters.
I love that episode so much. Listen, I think it can be fun for people who contribute to CanadaLand, who listen to CanadaLand, to see our stuff, I don't know, kind of break out and like actually hold space next to like schlocky true crime stuff and be like a breakup podcast in the States. If you want to see that happen, help us make that happen. Subscribe to the show and go and tell a friend about it.
Duly noted.
Robert, what do you have to duly note today?
John Iveson article. As you know, John Iveson is a great friend of Indian Country. And he had an article in the Post titled, Eco-Activist Liberal Ministers Could Ruin a $300 Million Lifeline for a Struggling BC First Nation. And it's a First Nation that was investing in a fish farm, which we all hate. And he said that the BC ministers are going to kill it. What I took issue there was the word struggling. And it's something that you often see in the media. And very often in reporting on Native things, that the media report that relies on a lot of really tired, old tropes. And one of them is that every First Nation is struggling. I know, you know, I've heard them on here too. I remember on Canada Land once I heard Wabkanoo referred to as, like, you know, the struggling street tough that became famous and stuff. And he's like a rich boy. He's like a rich private school kid.
Who said that? Did I say that?
You said that, and he's like, he's a rich private school kid whose parents were like professors.
I don't know what you're talking about. I heard his hip-hop work, and it was hella authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. But anyway, the point I'm getting at here is with Iveson, he calls this nation struggling. And whenever I see something like that, I just take a look at their books, just out of curiosity. And this is a First Nation whose accumulated budget surplus is $100,000 for every single person on a reserve. If Canada had that level of budget surplus, it would have a sovereign wealth fund three times larger than the largest other sovereign wealth fund in the world.
Yeah.
It would be the rich, literally the richest country on earth.
No, I hear what you're saying. He's using them as a prop. He's really defending this, like, fish farm, but the argument is, like, you're hurting the struggling native population.
Yeah, so basically what I want to duly note is stop doing that, and the way to stop doing that is to go into Google, search this term, First Nations Profiles, and that will take you to a federal government website that's updated every month that gives you every single demographic and economic fact about a First Nation. And that exists for Native people, including budget numbers and finance numbers and chief salaries and population statistics and everything. And I see so much bad reporting that can be corrected by simply Googling First Nations Profiles.
Is there a similar public-facing document I could have referred to fact-check whether or not Wabkanoo had a hard-knock life or not?
You could have read his book.
God, no. Duly noted. Robert, I got one last thing here. I usually say I'd like to duly note. I would not like to duly note this. I don't want to. I don't want to. You can't make me. All right, fine. Listen, I don't have grudges. We don't keep blacklists here at Canada Land, but I'd be lying to you if I were to tell you that there weren't, like, reporters whose work we tend to like more and others that were a little bit skeptical or eye-rolly about. And there's no secret here. Joe Warmington of the Toronto Sun has definitely been a reporter that we have been skeptical of, like, very slanted and sometimes sensationalistic coverage. So, yeah, I don't think you've ever heard a Joe Warmington duly noted that hasn't been somehow dunking on Joe Warmington. But the guy also is, like, kind of like an old school courtroom reporter and crime reporter. And, like, when you got a story, you got a story. I mean, maybe he's not the only one who had this story, but he's the one who I heard it from. So I'm going to duly note this story, Robert. Warmington reports in the Toronto Sun that he's at the murder trial of these three guys who are allegedly responsible for the 2021 Chicken Land killing, which sounds like a James Ellroy novel that should have existed. I don't mean to make light of this, like, a family was shot at, a guy was killed, and we're finding out in court what the alleged motive was. And that's where this wild detail comes out. I'll read here from the Warmington piece. The Crown attorney said they will argue that money from a business the suspects were involved in was funneled abroad to help fund the Islamic terror network. And the execution of a family was done by a group connected to ISIS who were allegedly trying to protect that information from being told to police. The alleged motive here is that these three guys opened fire at a Mississauga chicken land in order to stop somebody from telling the cops that they were working for ISIS. That is wild. I mean, the allegation here goes beyond just like that they self-radicalize. There is that in there, that they took an allegiance to ISIS and that they had ISIS propaganda on their phones. Like, okay, we've heard about that in Canada. It goes beyond that. The Crown attorney is saying that these guys were involved in, like, a money funneling operation to ISIS, like a direct ISIS cell. I have no idea if that's true. This is an allegation coming out in a murder charge. There's no other information out there of an RCMP investigation into an ISIS cell. It's also something that I think deserves some attention if they feel like they have enough evidence to put forth this defense. So I am duly noting it.
Duly noted.
That shortcuts this week. Robert, Thank you for joining me. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Robert, people can hear you on Pretendians. Where else can they find you?
On Pretendians. That's about it.
All right. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.